News Talk 1360 WCHL presents D.G. Martin with Who's Talking, Sunday mornings from 8 to noon.
Well, welcome to Who's Talking. This is D.G. Martin. Well, Maya Angelou, speaking about John Hope Franklin's new autobiography, which is called In Mirror to America, she says he is a true role model. He embodies the native optimism, which is that one can go from slavery to freedom, from ignorance to intelligence, can experience cruelty, yet manifest kindness. And that, I mean, that's just one view about your new biography. Welcome,
Dr. She's very generous. Thank you very much, G.G. I'm glad to be here.
Well, thanks for coming over to Durham from Chapel Hill. We're glad to have you close by, and we claim you in many respects as part of this larger community. The Mirror to America is not your first book, by any means, and it's an extraordinary effort. It's hard to – well, it's not recently anymore. You're 90 years old, but you're writing this book, publishing it, looking back on 90 years of being an American. Why did you – what prompted you to do this?
Well, let me say, first of all, that every book seems like the first book. So I'm as excited about this as I am as I was about Free Negro in North Carolina, which was published in 1943. I think writing and publishing is an exciting experience.
When the fresh book comes off the press and you have your first haven't found a typo yet, or you haven't found the first error yet.
It's like a newborn baby. I was thinking about writing an autobiography quite some time ago. I think that the genre, the biography as a genre. Struck me when I was working on George Washington Williams.
I do want to – can Alice, maybe we just ought to go to that right now, that you wrote – this is not your first experience with biography, first with autobiography, but you've done two that I remember. One is with another – the biography of another distinguished African-American historian.
Yes.
Whom you admire, and the other of your father.
My dad wrote it himself. I just edited, my son and I edited that one. But I'd been involved in autobiography as a way of handling something on biography as far back as 35 or so years ago when I was professor at the University of Chicago, and I was the editor-in-chief of a series of published by the University of Chicago Press called African-American Biography and Autobiography. And I had planned to use George Washington Williams as a kind of model there. But it took me a while to get that together, a while meaning 40 years. And so the biographers and autobiographers were rolling off the press under my editorship.
You were a great editor, but you were not – you were not the best authors under your own supervision of getting your book in on time.
That's right. That's right. Writing George Washington Williams was quite an experience, the greatest historical experience that I've had. I created him with the help of others. I created him from nothing. I didn't know. I just knew his name in 1944. I didn't know anything but his name.
And his work. You were familiar with
– well, I became familiar with his work after I knew his name.
I see.
And his work impressed me because here was a man in the 1870s and 80s writing a two-volume history of the Negro race in America. And I am in the 1940s and 50s trying to write a one-volume history of the Negro race in America. So that I was most impressed with his undertaking, and I said, "I'm gonna see about this man. I'm gonna work on him." Well, it took a while, and I worked on him, and he was very elusive. he wasn't, he not deliberately, but there was just almost nothing about him. And I had to chase him around and get things on him. I began to travel to get things on him. I went to Canada. I went to Belgium. I went to England. I finally went to Africa, West Africa, where he was, where he'd been. He'd been in the Congo and criticizing Leopold's policies in the Congo. And I went there, followed him there. I got to the point where I couldn't follow him anymore because the Congo at that time, which was the Zaire, was under the dictatorship of Mobutu, and I couldn't even take a picture of him, of any sight. In he wasn't there, but I couldn't take a picture of the river or of the port, anywhere he went. I just could not. But I did run into some people who knew him, who knew about him and who'd worked on him. A Belgian priest who was still there and whom I met had written a paper on him, and that was great good fortune. I finally pieced him together, and after 40 years of writing and struggling and searching, I published the biography of George Washington Williams, and it was a great experience just arriving at that point where I could publish it. And I suppose that stimulated me in my interest in biography and autobiography. And it had a lot to do, I think, with my deciding that I wasn't going to do like Williams and leave nothing. I was going to leave something so that people wouldn't have to start from scratch learning about me. Then in the 1980s, people began to ask me questions about myself. And it was fairly clear to me that they were anticipating the possibility of writing about me. And I said, well, I better get my
Version of it first.
That's right. I better get my version first. And so I began seriously to think about it. And about 4 years ago, I said I was going to do it.
Well, there are developing from your sort of public persona, not as a historian, but as a participant in public policy, and your conversations and speeches with people, as the your scholarly work intersected with advocacy work, you began to talk about your experience growing up in Oklahoma, about your and these became kind of a litany of who John Hope Franklin was, his parents and their commitment to, you know, not participating in non segregated activities, even though they were right there in the middle of a segregated situation. And you and your mama being removed from the railroad because she expressed reservations about moving from the white car to the black car while the train was moving.
Yes.
And your encounters at Fisk with the when you tried to make change.
Yes,
or,
yes.
To try to be helpful.
Yes.
Or as a Boy Scout trying to lead a white woman, a blind white woman, across the street, and she was very happy until she got about halfway across the street and found out you were black. Then she didn't want you to help her anymore. These kind of litany of reminders to those of us who didn't have these experiences that this was a life, that these things had an impact on you.
Yes.
and that you're not forgetting them.
And they're happening right here in the land of the free and the home of the brave, and where we're touting goodwill and touting freedom and equality and whatnot. The contradiction was stark, and I couldn't resist seeing
it. That litany, and all of it's, of course, now made permanent in your book, Mirror to Freedom, A Mirror to America, which is your autobiography. I want to focus on the Chapel Hill aspect of it, and it has to do with the writing and the research and the publication of your first book. And let's do that after we take a quick break.
Sure.
Talking to John Hope Franklin about his new book, an autobiography, Mirror to America.
Good morning, Aubrey. Good morning, Ron. You got a good joke for us today?
I do, and this is one of my own.
Uh-oh, I'm scared. Let's hear it then.
A horse walks into a bar, and the bartender says, "Why the long face?"
Oh, no. That was bad.
Please help Ron Stutz by sending us your clean jokes. The Molly Mae Clean Joke of the Day is read every morning at 7:50 a.m. So not only will you receive recognition for being hilarious, but you'll become eligible to win a $100 gift certificate good for Molly Mae House Cleaning, Molly Mae Carpet Cleaning, or Mr. Handyman Services. Not too shabby, huh? So go ahead and send us your jokes to cleanjoke@wchl1360.com. That's cleanjoke@wchl1360.com.
Looking for the perfect spot for a party, luncheon, or rehearsal dinner? We've got it at Spanky's. Spanky's can accommodate 20 to 100 in two beautiful private rooms overlooking Chapel Hill's busiest intersection. It's centrally located, there's ample parking just around the corner, and we can create a menu that will fit any occasion, from light hors d'oeuvres to a seven-course banquet. If you need a perfect setting for that special occasion, call Spanky's at 967-2678. That's 967-2678.
Who's Talking with D.G. Martin can be heard once again Sunday mornings on News Talk 1360 WCHL.
Welcome back to Who's Talking. This is D.G. Martin. John Hope Franklin and I are talking about his new book, his autobiography, Mirror to America. And I've asked him to share with us his sort of first experiences about being in the Chapel Hill, Raleigh-Durham area in connection with the research and writing of your PhD thesis, which became your
Free
first
Negro.
Book.
Yes, The Free Negro in North Carolina. I came down to Raleigh in the spring of 1939.
And where, you were a graduate student?
I was a graduate student at Harvard at the time. And I had reached the point where I had taken my general PhD examinations. The next stage was to write a dissertation. And so I had conferred with my dissertation advisor, and we'd come to the conclusion that it was worth my time to search out information on free Negroes in North Carolina.
Let me just say, why North Carolina? You grew up in Oklahoma. You went to school at Fisk in Tennessee. Was North Carolina?
Let me say that, DJ, that I had written a paper on free Negroes in the antebellum South. As an undergraduate at Fisk. When I went to graduate school, I didn't have any intention of pursuing that subject. I wanted to write on. First, I wanted to be a historian of England.
Can I just interrupt you? But this is the part of one part of your life that just fascinates me, and that is, and you can fit it, you can feel it in the autobiography, and that is this being torn between writing about interesting aspects of the African-American experience and being a historian who is not tagged with specializing just in the African-American experience. And it manifests itself right there at this moment.
Right. And there was a kind of a tension in my own life, in my own mind about what I should do. And I concluded I'd like to be a historian of England and write about England.
But why England?
Well, I had been studying England as an undergraduate, and when I went to Harvard, one of the most fascinating courses I had was a course on the history of England. And that would give me an opportunity to show that I wasn't really identified with any particular racial group in my research and everything. And so I wanted to work on England. I also had first month I was there, I got a job typing the dissertation of a young man who was in English history. His father, though, was vice president of the First National Bank of Boston, and he was a descendant of the Adams family, so he didn't start from scratch, either in terms of his knowledge or in terms of his resources. I remember so well that he was. This was before transatlantic telephone was in vogue, but he and his fiancée would be communicating. He was engaged to an English girl. They were communicating almost daily by cable, that sort of thing. And I said,
at $10 and $15 a clip.
That's the life. But I looked at my own resources, and I knew that I didn't have a chance to ever to get to England, ever in life. And so I thought it was ridiculous to be talking about working in British history when I couldn't.
So North Carolina was the second choice to England.
No, it wasn't the second. It was the third. For after I gave up on England, I then wanted to do Christian socialism in the United States, the rise and development of Christian socialism. And I was thinking seriously about that. When I began to look into it, I realized that there was a chap named James Dombrowski who was already staked out the field and who was about to publish his first book in that area. So that wasn't going to fly either.
So your third choice was North Carolina.
My third choice was Free Negroes. There had been a book done on Free Negroes in Virginia, Free Negroes in Maryland, the third likely place was North Carolina with the largest number
of free blacks.
Maryland had the largest number of free blacks. Virginia had the second largest. North Carolina had the third largest, 30,000 free blacks
during the time of
slavery, who had no – who were not slaves, you see.
Well, that also left it provided a little guidance in terms of both the successes and the mistakes that the scholars who did Maryland and Virginia – you had a pathway.
The general parameters of this problem had been examined, explored by these two authors of the Virginia Free Blacks and Maryland Free Blacks. So that they had blazed the trail a bit there, and I thought this was just perfect. So I decided to work on pre-Negroes North Carolina, and my advisors at Harvard thought that was just a capital idea.
Well, the only connection you had with North Carolina was a romantic connection. I think that's right, isn't it? I mean, that was
You're quite right. I had been to Western North Carolina to a YMCA conference back in the 1932, and I had taught in North Carolina in 1937 at A&T in Greensboro, just summer school, just to make some money to get back to Harvard. One of my college classmates was my girlfriend. I had dated all through college, and we were still dating, although we weren't seeing each other. We were dating by mail.
By mail.
in 1936, 37, 38.
And where was she?
She was in Goldsboro part of the time. She was in Northampton County part of the time, teaching there. And then this particular time, 1939, she was back in graduate school at Hampton University, where she was studying library science.
But North Carolina was still closer to her than Cambridge. I'm just trying to think if maybe romantic interest intersected with scholarly interest.
Well, it was a happy intersection, shall we say. I was delighted to have a subject to bring me closer to Aurelia, my girlfriend, so that I seized on North Carolina with great speed, and I loved it. And it got to be a very good subject.
I think the thing that interests us or interests me at this point in time, you know, gosh, 60 years, is that right?
Yes,
50, 60 years mm-hmm. after the fact, it's just impossible for us really to put ourselves back in your shoes at that time to come. First of all, you're now from Harvard.
Yes.
And then you're coming into a North Carolina, which is not the same North Carolina as it is today in terms of its respect for academic enterprises. And you're coming into in what was maybe the roughest time in terms of segregated times ever in the 20s and 30s and then maybe early 40s. Yeah. This was a rough. So what was it like to come down to do academic research in a place where it wasn't – there wasn't a pathway for black scholars?
No. I remember so well coming to North Carolina, first looking for a place to live. I went to the Arcade Hotel, which had been recommended to me. This is sort of a network. Blacks knew.
This is in Raleigh. You're looking
this
for
is in Raleigh, but blacks knew. If I missed out, I was going to Raleigh. Someone knew that there was an Arcade Hotel there.
That's where you can go, John Hope.
Yes,
that's where I could go.
And I went there, and I asked for a room. They said, "Shirley, how long you'll be here?" I said, "I'll be here for several months." They said, "We don't rent rooms like that. These are for overnight people. These are transients." They were very generous and very hospitable, very kind, but they didn't want to tie up a room like that. They had no rates for rooms by the week or by the month. And they said, "We can recommend you a place for you to stay." They had a whole list of places that where women, men would take in roomers. But they said, "But we strongly and cordially invite you to eat your meals with us." They said, "But we'll suggest a place for you." They suggested a place. I went there. The woman was very cordial, very generous, very welcoming. And so I took a room at Mrs. Alice Jones on Cabarrus Street in Raleigh. And I could stay there indefinitely, by the month or by the week or whatever. Meanwhile, I would go to Arcade Hotel to have my breakfast and my lunch and my dinner if I wanted to eat there. And that was also, I got settled there. And then I went to the archives on the next Monday morning. I got there on the weekend.
Now, had you written in advance to tell them you were coming, or did they expect you?
I had not. I had not written in advance.
And so you just kind of walked in, and I'm just trying to put myself in. I mean, it's hard to do, but I'm trying to put myself into the position of the clerk or the person who's keeping the gate at the Department of Archives and History. And
you see, I assumed that the archives was open to everyone and that I would be welcome there.
Well, now, did you really assume that in the basis?
Yes, I did assume it. I had no experience in the state archives except in Nashville, Tennessee, when I was a student at Fisk, I worked on that Free Negroes and in the Antebellum South, and I just walked in and sat down and worked. And I thought I could do the same in North Carolina, but I couldn't. I went to see the archivist, I went to see him because he was the person to see. And he said that, to be very frank with you, when they designed this building, they didn't have in mind any African-Americans. So we don't have a place for you to work. He said, "But I think you should be able to work here, and I want a little time when I can make some arrangements for you to work here. So perhaps in a week I can have everything all set." I didn't know whether he wanted a week to examine the policy or whether he wanted a week to make some segregated arrangements. But in any case, I thought that was a fair long time for me to be sitting, paying rent, and eating, and not doing anything on the mission which I was there to do. So I just looked at him, and he said, "Well, what about 3 days? I said, "Well, I'll come back Thursday." This is Monday morning. I came back Thursday, and he'd set aside a little room for me across from the search room. I don't know what it had been used for. It was well, a storage room maybe for exhibits. And he cleaned it out, put a table and a chair and a wastebasket in there, and said, this is where you can work. It's across the aisle, across the lobby, shall we say, from the large, very commodious search room for whites.
So you were instrumental in helping to establish a study room for blacks.
Well, you can put it that way. Instrumental in establishing segregated facilities. Too.
Well, you had to in order to do your job, you had to acquiesce, I guess, into that arrangement. Let's take a quick break. I want to come back and talk some more about that topic, which interests me a lot. We're talking with Dr. John Hope Franklin about his new autobiography, and he and I'll be right back.
Hi, this is Alan Stevenson from Team Wireless, and my trip to the Consumer Electronics Show in Vegas was very, very interesting. The new things that are coming in the way of wireless devices are incredible, to say the least. And with my new BlackBerry, I was able to look for new things for the business while staying in touch and on top of emails that used to pile up until I got back in town. The ease and speed of using my new BlackBerry has allowed me to travel more while staying connected. I also took my laptop with our newest Sierra Wireless Air Card and had high-speed internet access the whole trip. Hotspots or Wi-Fi spots are no longer needed with this product, and the speeds are awesome. I was able to show my website to people I met and visit theirs as we spoke, and that made doing business much easier. If you're considering a BlackBerry at this time or a wireless air card, our prices have never been lower. In fact, the air card is free for businesses at this time. Call us to schedule a demo at 489-2929. That's 489-2929. And remember the name, Team Wireless.
Question, do you believe that real men have to clean their own gutters? You know the routine. Your wife suggests that having the gutters tended to by professionals might be a good investment for many reasons. But you're offended by the idea because it's your house and you're the man and you're going to clean those gutters if it's the last thing you do. But in truth, it really is the last thing you do. I'm Charlie Quayle of Gutter Solutions. My certified team will install our now famous Leaves Out gutter covers and will help you keep your promise of clean gutters. Don't underestimate the wear and tear that your house and gutters take from improper maintenance. Protect your investment and add value by installing Leaves Out gutter covers. And remember the timeless proverb, real men stop gutter clutter with Leaves Out.
Call Gutter Solutions today at 967-7979 or find them on the web at leavesout.com.
Welcome back to Who's Talking. John Hope Franklin and I are talking about his newest book, Mirror to America, which is his autobiography. And we're focusing on some of the North Carolina aspects of it. You were talking about your experiences
yes.
as you came to do research on the free Negro in North Carolina.
Right.
And at a time when although the Civil War was over, you were learning that the Negro really wasn't free in North Carolina even then.
Well,
or not,
yes.
Not.
So Crittenden, Christopher Crittenden.
He was the archivist.
Yes, he was the archivist of the state. PhD from Yale. Very well
and
trained.
Somebody you came to have a good, very good relationship with.
Oh, yes, of course. And he not only provided me with this room, but he said that, in view of the fact that the pages wouldn't expect to serve you, we're going to give you a key and let you use the stacks yourself. And this is your dolly wagon, your wagon that you can bring your things out on. So I had this wagon, I had this key, And you, the only way to get into the stacks was to go through the search room where they were whites. And it was a very large room. I would sort of slow down so I could see what was going on in there. And then I stuck my key in the door and went into the stacks and browsed around and got my materials and came through that search room where whites were sitting and on out into the lobby, across the lobby, into my little room. I did that for about 2 weeks, coming through there with my little dolly overloaded, manuscripts just almost falling off, you know, just loaded down. And at the end of 2 weeks, Dr. Crittenden called me in and said that I'm going to have to relieve you of your key. I said, what's going on? I don't know how am I going to get? He said, well, I've had a delegation from white researchers protesting that they were being discriminated against because they couldn't go into the stacks and get what they wanted, and I could do it. He says, you can go into the stacks and get what you want. And they said, that was unfair. He said, and I could not give keys to all these people who want keys, so I have to take your key and put you on the same level with them. He said, and then you have to come into the search room and make the request for a certain set of papers like the others, and you then retreat to your room, and the pages, who I didn't know would serve you, will have to serve you. They'll have to bring whatever you want over to you. Of course, this
ironically, the treatment, the second-rate treatment that they were giving you turned out to be better treatment in that respect than the ordinary treatment, but it didn't last long.
It didn't last long because you can't request the amount of material that I was getting anyway, and you can't be free to decide which box of materials you want, you see. You have to wait outside and let someone else make the judgments and that sort of thing. There. Very confining.
What were you just from a turning away from the sort of interesting treatment that you were receiving as a black scholar, in contrast to what the white scholars were receiving? What were you looking for in the archives in terms of doing basic research on the free Negro in North Carolina?
I was trying to find out about things like how many farmers there were, how many artisans there were, how many maids and servants there were. I was trying to get some occupational distribution. I wanted to see where they were living, you see, what part of the state they were in, where the concentration of them was, and all the things that had to do with the demographics, had to do with occupation, had to do with ownership of land and that sort of thing. And you could get so much of that from the archival material, not only from the unpublished census schedules, which I could use, but also from the papers of John Manley, for example, who was a free Negro slave owner down in Newburgh.
A free Negro who owned slaves.
That's right.
And kept records, and
that's
so you
right.
could.
That's right. That's right. And all kinds of other things like that. That I was trying to get a picture of just what their life was like.
It is sticking now with the subject of your research, which is Free Negro in North Carolina, later to be your first book. And you knew what was going on across the South, sort of generally. You knew specifically from these prior works that had been published in Maryland and Virginia. Did it differ from state to state very much, or was it all pretty much a pattern?
It differed very markedly from state to state. The laws were different. The laws governing them were different, depending on the experiences that the state had had with these. Free Negroes were an anomaly. They weren't supposed to exist, you see. This is a slave society. And free Negroes were a threat. Their very existence were a threat to the slave society. so that Virginia might react one way depending on its topography as well as its demography. You know, you got mountains, you've got one situation. When you got the sea, you've got another situation. Maryland would be different because of its proximity to the north. They run away more in the north. They come back as free persons. They might run into Maryland from Virginia and North Carolina and act as free persons there. So they're all fairly different.
What I've always been curious in a time where before identity cards and Polaroid pictures and the kinds of things that we use to identify ourselves now, how a person, say a free Negro in any society, how would you go about proving that you were who you said you were?
You better have some papers. This is before a driving license, before IDs, but you'd better have some paper on you, particularly if you were sort of going around in an area where you were not known. You see, the sight of a black person caused people to presume that he was a slave, he or she was a slave. Now, if you weren't a slave, you'd better be able to prove that you were not. Otherwise, you could be taken up by any white person and be claimed as a slave. And so since you have no standing in court, you can't take an oath. As a black person, you can't take an oath.
Free or slave.
Free or slave. You cannot take an oath. So that your word is nothing. Your word means nothing. Unless you got a piece of paper signed by a white person that indicates that you are free, then the presumption is that you're a slave.
So at any point, without papers, you're at risk of...
You're at risk. You may be taken up and sold, or taken up and jailed as a runaway.
Well, I'm interested in all of this. We need to take a break, and I want to come back, and I want to talk, if we can, just about the mechanics and the way that this research project turned into your first book.
Okay.
We'll be right back talking to John Hope Franklin about his new book, Mirror to America, his autobiography. We'll be right back.
You can hear D.G. Martin with a replay of Who's Talking from the whole week, Sunday mornings on News Talk 1360, WCHL.
WCHL 1360, time now for Biography for Radio with Jack Perkins, brought to you locally by the Cedars and East-West Partners community.
He tosses out gags like sticks of dynamite. Sometimes people are so offended, he blows up his own show. His story next on Biography for Radio.
Do you know your credit score? You should, because staying on top of your credit could help save you thousands of dollars. You can now get your credit score and credit report at freecreditreport.com.
I go online and in seconds I get my credit report and credit score free.
I can even print it right off my computer.
Staying on top of my credit helped me save a lot of money.
Get your free credit report and score when you sign up for a 30-day credit monitoring trial at freecreditreport.com. That's freecreditreport.com.
He's been called everything from a bigot to a hypocrite. His jokes can be ruthless. Most often, he's simply funny. He was born into a family of rabbis and at age 25 became one himself. But it seemed the only time he reached his congregation was when he cracked a joke. So he quit the synagogue and headed for Los Angeles. His gnome-like looks and daring humor got him on the Ed Sullivan Show. In 1964, as he was on camera, Sullivan indicated he should wind up. The comedian allegedly responded with a finger motion of his own. Furious, Sullivan banned him from the show. For 20 years, the renegade comic wallowed. But in the 80s, he made a comeback with packed shows on Broadway. He didn't always succeed. His musical Laughing Room Only closed early. But his political wit won worldwide recognition. Israel awarded him for valor. Nelson Mandela invited him to South Africa. Still deliciously deadpan and attacking everything from fad diets to corporate fraud, he is comedian Jackie Mason. For Biography, I'm Lawrence Scott.
Biography is a trademark of A&E.
Biography for Radio, brought to you on WCHL by the Cedars of Chapel Hill and East West Partners Community. The Cedars is the country's premier retirement community. Call 929-1995 to find out more on this very special community. Life has been good to you. Now it gets even better at the Cedars of Chapel Hill.
Who's Talking with D.G. Martin can be heard once again Sunday mornings on News Talk 1360 WCHL.
Welcome back to Who's Talking. John Hope Franklin and I are talking about his life because he's written his autobiography, Mirror to America, which is a brand new book which is being recommended highly for people for presents and for libraries. It's gotten good attention. Speaking of books, we're talking about the research, your research in North Carolina in pre-civil rights days when blacks were in a system of pretty much total segregation, and you're trying to be a scholar. How did this research work that you did in North Carolina turn into your first book?
Well, let me say, first of all, that not only did I work in the archives in Raleigh, I worked at the library at the University of North Carolina, and I worked at the library at Duke University. And there was no segregation in
at either of these places, at the university libraries.
The university library, I was free to do as I pleased. I was not interested in the big reading rooms. I don't know what would happen there. But in the research facilities, I was able to go in and out, do as I pleased. As a matter of fact, they had a display of at the anniversary, the 75th anniversary of the Southern Historical Collection a few months ago. They had an exhibit which had where people signed in and signed out as they came in to do research. And my name was listed with Van Woodward's name and with Merton Coulter's name, other people. But my point is that there was no discrimination, no segregation.
Well, what about?
And that same thing was true at Duke University, too.
What about people in Chapel Hill back then? Now, you give us a viewpoint, not just as a black scholar in a segregated world coming to Chapel and to come into essentially a segregated institution as far as the university was concerned. But you began to make contacts, professional contacts with people here.
Yes.
And also social contacts with people that folks in Chapel Hill may not remember, but remember their names. And
yes, Guyon B. Johnson. Guyon Johnson was an outstanding researcher. She'd received her PhD at the University of North Carolina, and she'd written a book on antebellum North Carolina. And it was a huge book. It was a very informed book, very good. And I just couldn't wait to meet Mrs. Johnson.
So you'd read her. You'd looked at her book.
I'd
was
read
part of your source materials.
Sure,
for
I'd
your
read
book.
A book. Mm-hmm. And she had a chapter on free Negroes in her big book on antebellum North Carolina. So I couldn't wait to meet her. And I came over here. This is before I moved to Chapel Hill. I did take a room here for some weeks later. But I came over here on the bus from Raleigh, got here early one morning, went to the drugstore there. What's the name of it? Sutton's Drugstore, and called her. Well, they said that she was gone to take the children to school. And I concluded that this must be her grandchildren or her great-grandchildren, because anyone who'd written a book that big must be an old woman, just could barely get around. So they said, call back later, and I called back later, and Guyon Johnson answered the telephone. She said, where are you? I told her where I was. Where are you? I said, I'm at Sutton's Drugstore. She said, just stay there. I'll be right down. She came down, jumped out of her car, and here was this very attractive, youngish white woman who I thought must have been the daughter of Guyon Johnson. No, she said, I'm Guyon Johnson. I said, I'm sure she must have seen a surprised look on my face that this woman was still fairly young and still, but had written this
and had children in school.
This book and had children in school. So she said, "Come on and get in the car, and we'll go to my house." And she took me out to her house, and she pulled out all her files, all her materials, and shared them with me. And Guy, her husband, came to lunch, and there she and I were down on the floor with all this material. And he took it. He was not surprised at all. He was just very cordial. We had lunch together, the three of us, and he went on back to his office at the university, and she and I resumed this narration, telling me all about where the materials were and how valuable they were and so forth. And so we became friends for life from that day. And we had the best time ever. Another friend that was so helpful was... Howard K. Beale.
Ah.
Howard K. Beale, who was a professor in the Department of History and who was acquainted with my thesis advisor, Paul Buck, Paul Buck had told him to look me up. So when I was teaching at St. Augustine's, my second year in the state, here is a guy, Howard Beale, standing at the door in the dormitory in his Chesterfield overcoat and his bowler hat and his calling card in his hand.
He's come to call on you.
He's come to call on me, and I'm living in the men's dormitory upstairs, you see. And it was so amusing that he would come to me. He'd been to the concert. His mother was in the car. He came in to see me and to invite me to visit them in Chapel Hill, which I did, and
well,
we became friends.
We've been talking to John Hope Franklin about his book, Mirror to America, his autobiography, and we'll look forward to having Dr. Franklin back with us sometime soon to continue the conversation and look forward to being with all of y'all same time tomorrow.
Everything you need is at Hold Your Own for bathrooms, kitchens, your laundry room, your bedroom, any room. Got a storage problem? Come to Hold Your Own. They've got the best for all of your organization and storage needs, from home decor to auto organization. So simplify your life. Go to Hold Your Own today. Hold Your Own Organizing and Storage Solutions. Hold Your Own in Eastgate Shopping Center.
This is D.G. Martin. So many people who live here and visit here are talking about so many exciting events, projects, and ideas. You know, it's too bad we can't sit them down and get them to explain why they're so fired up about what they're doing. Too bad nothing. That's what we do every weekday evening at 6 and 10. And on Sunday morning on Who's Talking on News Talk 1360, WCHL, Chapel Hill Carrboro's News Talk and Tar Heel Station.
And now, here's Deborah Miller from A Southern Season.
From our legendary Tar Heels to our incomparable quality of life, our hometown pride is evident at every turn. Named one of America's outstanding retailers at the International Fancy Food Show, we're bursting at the seams with award-winning gifts of good taste, glorious flavors, and gustatory delights. Our family of customers extends far and wide, but we wouldn't even think of calling anywhere else home.
A Southern Season, Chapel Hill's landmark gourmet emporium at University Mall.
All day and all night, make News Talk 1360 WCHL your listening post for breaking news and be in touch with the town and the world. At home, at work, in the car. News Talk 1360 WCHL, Chapel Hill, Carrboro's News Talk and Tar Heel Station.